This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to ask two longtime Middle East peace proponents, one an Israeli, the other a Palestinian, how the war in Lebanon and the war in Iraq have affected prospects for negotiating a Middle East peace. A little later, we'll hear from Sari Nusseibeh, the president of Al-Quds University, the Arab university in Jerusalem. He co-founded a peace initiative with a former Israeli security chief. Our first guest is Yossi Beilon, the chairman of the Meretz Yachad party in the Israeli Knesset. Beilon was an architect of the peace plans, the Geneva Initiative, and the Oslo Accords, which was signed at a 1993 White House ceremony in which Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat shook hands. In 2000, Beilon participated in Middle East peace talks in Taba. He's also held several ministerial positions in the Israeli government. Yossi Beilon, welcome to Fresh Air. You serve in the Knesset, but did the war take you by surprise?
Yeah, I must admit that it was a surprise, and that 6 years since our withdrawal from Lebanon were very quiet years and flourishing ones. We said, my party said, and I personally said, that since we withdrew totally from Lebanon, there was no justification for any military act against Israel. And once Hezbollah provoked us the way they did by kidnapping two soldiers and killing eight others, there was a full justification for Israel to react militarily. Then the question, of course, was what kind of a reaction should we choose? And this is a different question.
So what is your opinion of how Israel conducted the war?
Since Syria was the force behind Hezbollah, and without Syria, Hezbollah could not have acted, that some military targets in Syria were much more justified than civilian targets in Lebanon. So my initial idea was that the target was not properly chosen. Then we thought that the ground operation were totally a mistake. I mean, that after a few days of air attacks, we should have ended this operation and try to have the best UN resolution. Rather than that, we continued the war, and we decided to go for a ground operation, and then even to enlarge it until the Litani River, which was a very big mistake.
Was Israel waiting for the opportunity to try to destroy Hezbollah's arsenal?
I'm not so sure. I think that we were taken by surprise. We were not 100% prepared. And I'm not sure whether the government of Israel waited for such a moment. I mean, perhaps there were people who said, well, it is better to have such an operation, a surgical operation right now, and not to wait until they are much better equipped. But I don't think that this was a real preparedness on our side, and that people waited for this moment.
What do you think the war has done to Israel's image and to the image of its army?
Regretfully, I cannot say that we won the war of images, and that despite some of the achievements, like the decrease of the power of Hezbollah and the decision of the Lebanese army to deploy itself in the south of Lebanon after more than 30 years of Israeli requests which were rejected, still, the general feeling is that it was far from a victory. And this has some bad ramifications on some of our enemies who believe that Israel is not as powerful as they had thought.
So do you think that in some ways that means the war leaves Israel more vulnerable?
It's a little bit too early to judge, because one can also raise a counter-argument and to say that it was easier for Israel to have peace with our neighbors when their feeling was of a kind of asymmetry, rather than when they felt that we won and they were totally defeated. This is especially right about Egypt and us after the 73 war, in which they thought that there was a big achievement for them, rightly or wrongly. And here, what I'm trying to think is whether it would be possible, against the background of the results of this war, to say, okay, you feel that you succeeded, rightly or wrongly, let's negotiate now, and it will be easier for you to negotiate with us. And we might get an agreement right now rather than years ago because of the very, let's say, vague results of this war.
And negotiate with who? You're talking about negotiating with Hezbollah, with Hamas?
First of all, I would negotiate with everybody who is ready to negotiate with me. Neither Hezbollah nor Hamas is ready to negotiate with Israel, which leaves us with the government of Lebanon, with Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, and the Palestinian Authority, and with the Syrian government. All of them are speaking about an agreement with Israel, which is a very, very unique situation and a very positive one. And I think that we have to seize this opportunity rather than to dismiss it, and try perhaps to go for another international conference, kind of a Madrid II. The first Madrid conference took place in 91. After 15 years, I think that it is about time to reconvene, to analyze the achievements, to refer to the things which have not taken place yet, and to see how can we have peace with Syria, with Lebanon, and with the Palestinians.
My impression is that right now, the war has affected confidence in Israel about pursuing a negotiated peace, and that seeing what the Hezbollah militia is capable of, and seeing, you know, Hamas kidnap an Israeli soldier after Israel had withdrawn from Gaza, that a lot of Israelis have lost confidence in the peace process, and that the war and the Hamas kidnapping has reinforced the idea that Israel should at least temporarily give up on the idea of a negotiated peace. Is that an accurate reading of Israeli public opinion?
I don't think so. No? I don't think so. I think that people lost their confidence in a unilateral arrangement because of Lebanon and Gaza, and they feel that Israel was the one which was ready to give up, and the other side did not appreciate it, and in a way breached the non-agreement. I don't think that the same refers to peace agreements, because, I mean, it is very obvious. We have a peace agreement with Egypt since 79. We have a peace agreement with Jordan since 94. And these are the big achievements of Israel. Neither interim agreements nor unilateral steps were as successful. So I believe that, although I did not see new polls, but I do believe that the situation is that people are very disenchanted by unilateralism after a period of a year or so, whereby they thought maybe this was a nice substitute for agreements. And they understand today that peace agreements do not have substitutes.
Now, you mentioned skepticism, growing skepticism about unilateral withdrawals. You were one of the advocates of unilateral withdrawal from Lebanon in 2000. Do you have any second thoughts on how that was conducted?
No, not at all. I think that it is very clear that somebody like me would always, also in the future, support unilateralism if the alternative is to remain in the occupied land. This went for Gaza, this went for Lebanon, and will go for the West Bank. But I will always try and convince the decision makers to have a peace agreement. And this happened years ago with Lebanon. I believe that we should have signed an agreement with Syria and paid the price of the Golan Heights in order to have this peace, knowing that it will have a huge impact on Lebanon, and that as a result of such an agreement, we will also withdraw from Lebanon. But the government of Israel, which was then the government of the Labour Party, and on which I served, was not ready to pay the price of the 100% of the Golan Heights. Barak was then the prime minister. And after a very, very important summit in Shepherdstown in December 1999, January 2000, he decided not to sign an agreement with Syria. And then I supported unilateralism as a fallback. And I think that what we got out of it is a relative silence for 6 years and a northern part of Israel which was flourishing in all these years. I don't think that anybody would now like to remain in Lebanon. And the proof is that nobody is suggesting today, after this operation, once we reoccupied South Lebanon, to stay there.
My guest is Yossi Beilin, an architect of a couple of Middle East peace plans and a member of the Israeli Knesset. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Yossi Beilin. He's chair of the Meretz Yachad party in the Israeli Knesset, and he's one of the architects of a couple of the major peace initiatives over the years and is a longtime advocate of a negotiated peace in the Middle East. What's left of the peace movement in Israel, and what is its position now?
Well, the peace movement in many ways won its day. I mean, what you have today is a government which is not the government of the peace camp, which is ready to have a Palestinian state. A prime minister who said some weeks ago that he was ready to give up on 90% of the West Bank without any return on the Palestinian side. So that, I mean, our big campaign of peace between us and our neighbors about Palestinian state, about putting an end to occupation, all these things became kind of a common denominator among most of the Israeli political parties, which is our huge, huge achievement. And I believe that today, especially when people see that it is not only a matter of force with which you solve problems and that you have to be diplomatic and you have to negotiate, I think that today we have a very special role and we are calling for immediate negotiations with all our neighbors, namely Syria, Lebanon, and the Palestinians. And we suggest a Madrid 2 conference in order to launch this process. I can also tell you that according to the polls which have been published in the last days, we are not losing. We are gaining.
But when Hamas controls the majority of seats in the Palestinian legislature and Hamas doesn't recognize Israel or its right to exist, how can you have a negotiated peace if you can't negotiate with Hamas?
Well, here the procedure is quite clear. The Hamas is telling the world that it is ready that Mahmoud Abbas will negotiate with Israel. Once he ends his negotiations, he will not be in a situation to decide for himself, but he will have to bring it either to a referendum or to a meeting of the Palestinian National Council. If there is a majority for such an agreement, then it will become a reality. This is what Hamas is saying. Now, there is now an opportunity for Hamas and Fatah to form a unity government. And I think that this would be a way for Hamas to stick to its ideology, but to enable others to negotiate on their behalf so that they will not be the ones to shake our hands, but they will benefit from an agreement with Israel, which is a kind of a process which they are going through while they are moving from a terrorist group or an opposition group into a political party in power.
So to sum up, in a time of incredible pessimism in the Middle East, you still hold out some optimism that this difficult time could be used as an opportunity to negotiate some kind of peace plan.
You're right.
Okay. Now, but, you know, a lot of people in Israel, I think, right now have the opinion that Hamas and Hezbollah are committed to the destruction of Israel and that Hezbollah's ability to hold its own in the war has reinforced that commitment. to the destruction of Israel. What's your reaction to that point of view?
Well, there is a big difference between the two groups. Hezbollah is not a partner. It's not a potential partner. It's, after all, a small group. And the success of Hezbollah to survive, of course, doesn't prove that Israel was not in a situation to put an end to this to its existence. Had Israel used all its power to do this. With Hamas, Hamas is a party which won, regretfully, the hearts of the majority of the Palestinians. And Hamas is going through a change, undoubtedly. It is not enough yet, but it is important. And I think that there are also some nuances inside this this movement too. And this is why I believe that with Hamas, at the end of the day, if they change their mind, or even if they just give Mahmoud Abbas the mandate to negotiate, there is a possibility to get to an agreement, which is not the case with Hezbollah. And I think that people understand this, the difference.
Meanwhile, what's the political war within Israel right now? You know, for example, there was a letter signed by hundreds of military reservists in Israel saying that their training was inadequate, the mission was unclear, and the military supplies and equipment were inadequate. What's happening in the Knesset now?
Well, I think that the situation right now is conducive to an investigation committee. Many forces are asking for it. In a vote in the Knesset yesterday, we had 25 members of Knesset supporting this idea and only 27 against it. So it was not far from becoming the declaration of the Knesset to have such an investigation committee. I believe that it won't be possible for the government to drag it for a long while, and eventually they will have to take a decision to have this committee. And then, once this committee is established by the Supreme Court and a senior judge will lead it, then I believe that part or most of this public protest will fade, because the main issue is this committee. It is true that we are going through a difficult process. Not only because of the war, but also because of the different allegations against the president, the prime minister, the minister of justice, and others. And it is both a difficult period, but on the other hand, I must admit, a very interesting one, with options which are open towards solutions. Because especially people in politics, under distress, might think that a big policy towards peace or towards something else will divert the attention of the people from criticism against them to the issue itself, and they may be right.
You know, in talking about peace, this is a time when we're seeing the rise of Islamic extremism throughout much of the Islamic world. And this extremist movement is not only very militant, it's very anti-Semitic and anti-Israel. How do you think the rise of this pan-Arab extremist Islam movement is affecting Israel's security and its options for a negotiated peace?
Well, it does penetrate the, I would say, inner circle of the Middle East. And the Arab countries around us are not immune against these trends. Still, I would like to reject the idea that what we have is a war of civilizations or war of religions. I think that everywhere, and also in the Islamic world, you have extremists, you have moderate people, you have pragmatic people. The wisdom is to create always the coalition of sanity. Those people who are much more moderate, much more pragmatic on both sides, and would want to live, and they want their kids to live. These are the majorities, by the way, everywhere. So the coalition of sanity is something which is available. And I think that the role of the peace camp is to put an end to the war situation in the inner circle, so that the inner circle, meaning Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Palestinians, will not create a pretext for those who want to fight forever, that they are fighting for some kind of a just cause, like the Palestinian state or something like this. The whole idea, and this was the idea of the late Yitzhak Rabin, he wanted very much to have peace in the inner circle before Iran is becoming a nuclear power, and before the hatred towards Israel is so big in the Arab world that anybody who will make peace with us will be seen as a traitor. And he was right, and it is still not too late.
Yossi Beilin is a member of the Israeli Knesset and chair of the Meretz Yachad party. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Yossi Beilin about how the wars in Lebanon and Iraq have affected prospects for a negotiated peace in the Middle East. Beilin is chair of the Meretz Yachad party in the Israeli Knesset. He was an architect of the peace plans, the Geneva Initiative, and the Oslo Accords. I'm interested in hearing how you think the war in Iraq has affected prospects for peace in the Middle East. When the Bush administration made the decision to invade Iraq, one of the arguments was that if you overthrow Saddam Hussein and create a democracy in Iraq, democracy will spread through the Middle East and help Israel negotiate a peace. And what do you think is the reality of that?
There are several impacts on the Middle East peace process. One, the United States administration is overwhelmed by Iraq, by the war in Iraq and its ramifications. There is no other issue on its agenda, no real other issue. As a result of it, the United States lost its energy, readiness, time to deal with other Middle East problems. Another point is Syria. Because of the very negative attitude of the United States to Syria against the background of the behavior of Syria in Iraq, the United States is boycotting Syria and cannot be anymore a mediator between Syria and Israel, which had been the case in the past. I believe that the interests of the United States, now being here in the Middle East, vis-a-vis many Middle Eastern forces, including Hezbollah, Hamas, and others, is tying its hands in its freedom to negotiate and to shuttle between us and our neighbors. So I would say that from many, many aspects, the results of the war on Iraq made it more difficult for us to achieve peace than before.
And finally, I'd like to know, just, you know, you've given us a lot of arguments why you think a negotiated peace plan is still possible, why the war can actually have opened doors if people allow those doors to be opened. But if it just taken your pulse for a second, if you could just give us a reading of how optimistic or pessimistic you're feeling right now.
I believe that there is an opening which wasn't there before. The big question is, how big is this opening? Is it big enough in order to change the situation towards peace, or is it just another ray of hope which might disappear? And this is why it is more than a matter of optimism or pessimism. It is a matter of creativity. It is a matter of readiness to be proactive and to do something towards it. And this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to speak with whoever I can in the leadership of the world, those whom I believe are relevant for the Israeli, Palestinian, Israeli, Syrian tracks, who can have their own influence and impact in order to make it possible for the different parties to have contacts, to talk to each other, and to go for serious negotiations after all these years. At least we now know what is the price, what should be done in order to have peace. And this is, I believe, a very important component towards peace. So I would say that I'm far from being pessimistic, but in order to be, I mean, I'm not just an optimist to believe that the situation will be better tomorrow. I believe that it is my task to make it so.
Yossi Beilin, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Yossi Beilin is a member of the Israeli Knesset and chair of the Meretz Yachad Party. Coming up, one of the leading Palestinian advocates of a negotiated two-state peace agreement, Sari Nusseibeh. This is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we're talking with an Israeli and a Palestinian advocate of a negotiated Middle East peace plan about how the wars in Lebanon and Iraq have affected prospects for peace. We just heard from Yossi Beilin. Our next guest, Sari Nusseibeh, is the president of Al-Quds University, the Arab University of Jerusalem. In 2003, along with a former Israeli security chief, Nusseibeh co-founded the People's Voice, an Israeli-Palestinian civil initiative for a negotiated two-state solution. In 1991, he was a member of the Palestinian Delegation Steering Committee at the Madrid Peace Conference. From 2001 to 2003, he was the PLO's Commissioner for Jerusalem Affairs. Dr. Nusseibeh, welcome to Fresh Air. Did the war between Israel and Hezbollah take you by surprise?
Yes, I think I certainly didn't expect the war to erupt in the way that it did. The whole series of events that led one after the other was took me totally by surprise, right to the very end, actually.
With Hezbollah emerging as a hero to many Muslims in the Middle East, how does this change the dynamics of the Middle East?
Well, there are two kinds of possible scenarios that might, I think, evolve from this. One is to assume that people will come out of this thinking that war or conflict or the use of force simply leads nowhere. That in the final analysis, whether it is force used by Israel against the Arab side or that used by the Arabs against the Israeli side, only leads to more conflict. But unfortunately, there's another line of thinking that might evolve, another lesson to be drawn, if you like, which is that on the Arab side, to say that force does seem to work, Hezbollah proved that Israel is not invincible, and so perhaps we should chuck away every thought we have about making peace with Israel. Let's just pursue the option of using violence. We need more training, perhaps. We can learn from Hezbollah. And I would also suggest that in a parallel way, similar conclusions can be drawn on the Israeli side. And by similar conclusions, I mean, on the one hand, people coming out of this saying violence doesn't work. And on the other hand, people coming out to say, clearly, violence needs to be, we need to become better at the use of violence, that the answer to what happened in Lebanon is technical, in the sense that we have to be better prepared, we have to have better intelligence, we have to carry out our war against the other side more efficiently, but that clearly we have therefore to develop our military strength. And my thinking is that most likely, unfortunately, both sides will come to the conclusion that we must equip ourselves better for a more effective use of force.
Many Israelis feel that they have been betrayed. Israel pulled out of Gaza, and then Hamas militiamen cross the border and kill and kidnap Israeli soldiers. Israel pulled out of Lebanon in 2000, and, you know, a few weeks ago, a soldier was kidnapped by Hezbollah. Some Israelis think that what are they to make of this? You know, they pull out of a region and they're attacked. So what alternatives does that give them? And I wonder what your reaction is to Israelis who feel so betrayed that they withdraw and are then attacked.
Well, I think, you know, you're quite right in the sense that in Israel, some people or many people will probably draw the conclusion from what happened, from the events, from the war, that it makes no sense to call for living at peace with the Arab neighbors, that the only way to survive, the only way to make sure that you continue to exist is to rely on a better capacity or ability to use force, that the Arab side is not trustworthy, not dependable, is not serious, not committed to peace or coexistence. But of course, you know, looked at from another perspective, let us say looked at from the perspective of people such as myself, who still believe in the possibility of peace, you would probably find people arguing, I certainly would argue, that the fault in the actions that were undertaken by Israel really lie with the way in which things happened, whether in Gaza or in Lebanon. In other words, the way that Israel withdrew, first of all, from Lebanon, and then later from Gaza, that as they withdrew, they did not withdraw on the basis of a political agreement or understanding with the other side. Now, and there's always been people, again, I'm one of them, who've argued that if you want to withdraw, it has to be done on the basis of a mutual agreement, of a clear vision concerning where you want to get to at the very end. Now, in Gaza, of course, it was clear, as Israel withdrew, that there was discontent on the Palestinian side. There was still a problem. People still felt under occupation. People still felt that Israel was taking the steps it was taking, not in order to reach peace with the Palestinians, but in order to reach better security arrangements for itself at the expense of the Palestinians being able to achieve their own rights.
Do you think that there are connections now between Hamas and Hezbollah, and do you think that the war has strengthened whatever connections existed? And I'll say that, you know, Hezbollah is a Shiite group, Hamas is a Sunni group, and the traditional wisdom has been that Sunni and Shia are more opponent than ally, but the conventional wisdom now is that that seems to be changing, and that Sunni and Shia groups, outside of Iraq anyway, seem to be uniting in some kind of opposition to the West.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised that you call it conventional wisdom. I mean, it's probably conventional only in some quarters to think or to have thought that Sunnis and Shiites are sort of pitted one against the other. Certainly in Iraq, there was a problem in the past few years. But in general, I wouldn't say necessarily and in all cases and always where you have Sunnis and Shiites, you have people fighting against each other. Very often you'll have Sunnis and Shiites close to one another, not fighting one another. And certainly as far as the Palestinians are concerned, the Palestinians, as you know, or at least, you know, I'm saying this for your listeners, are Sunni. The Muslim Palestinians are Sunni. They've never really had any ideological or political problems with the Shiites, whether in Syria or in Lebanon, that I know about. Of any importance. And so it's in fact very easy to see how the Shiites today in Lebanon or elsewhere for that matter would join hands with the Sunnis in the Hamas people, for example, in Palestine in order to work together. I think they've had contacts in the past together, and I believe that from this moment on, from the moment of the war that took place in Lebanon last month onwards, they're going to probably have a lot more to do with one another.
You had worked with the PLO, which was, I think it's fair to say, a secular militant group. Hamas is an Islamist group. And I wonder how you think life for Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza has changed under the government of Hamas. And if you think that things will reach the point where Palestinian women, for instance, are required to wear the veil.
Yeah. Well, first of all, to go back to your description of the PLO, you know, the PLO was supposed to be an umbrella group organization that allowed people with different backgrounds and their ideologies and so on to gather under the same roof. And it was like a structure, a vast political structure, which included all the different representations of ways of thinking among the Palestinian population, which at the time when it was created did not need to include an Islamicist faction or manner of thinking, because that faction only represented a small minority and it wasn't really interested in the national struggle and in the national efforts at bringing about independence and so on and so forth. So today, Hamas has become extremely strong. It's decided to become involved in politics. It ran for elections. It won. It is now in control and power. And certainly, as soon as they're able to, they haven't, by the way, been given the chance, because you know, there's been this siege, financial siege. They haven't been able to spend any money. The Israeli authorities have been picking them up, minister after minister, and putting them in jail, in my opinion, in a very sort of unacceptable way. And I say this, you know, as a non-Hamasist, but I think it's been terrible for our system that this has happened. But anyway, let's assume they do assume power properly and begin to implement this, then I think, you know, yes, there will be the rub, because either Palestinian society is prepared to accept a system of extremist religious government where, for example, women will not have equal rights, or where, for example, education is totally guided by religious rulings, where, and so on and so forth, or they will not.
One of the messages you've been trying to send Palestinians is that they have to give up the right of return, the right to go back to the homes that they lost in the 1940s. And I'm wondering how you reached that conclusion, that the right of return has to be taken off the table in order for a peace settlement to really work.
In this particular instance, I've come to the conclusion that it is impossible, in fact, to pursue the fulfillment of two rights I have, at least two rights I have, simultaneously, namely the right to return, as well as the right as a people to be free, to have independence, to be sovereign, to build a future for myself and for the people. Those two rights, namely the right to return, as well as the right to be free, simply cannot be simultaneously fulfilled. And so you have to make a decision. And, in, you know, what I've argued basically has been, you know, in the Palestinian case, we have to make up our minds. We have to decide which right do we give more importance or weight to. And, you know, I simply argued, and I still continue to argue, that it makes more sense to give more weight to the right to freedom, the right to be sovereign, the right to build the future. By the way, I just want to tell you, I mean, I'm not really a nationalist at heart, and I'm still for a two-state solution. But as far as I'm concerned, what really matters to me is coexistence. What really matters to me is that Israelis and Palestinians, whether as individuals or as Jews or as men or as women, live in equally dignified conditions, that they treat each other with respect equally. Now, I don't have a problem whether this can happen in one state, or it can happen in two states, or three states, or four states. I think we should not lose sight of the basic principles that must inform us as we try to find an acceptable way of living. And these principles are, I believe, you know, mutual respect, mutual dignity, recognition. It just seems that the most practical way of doing this at this moment in time is a two-state solution, and I think that's what we should go for.
My guest is Sari Nusebe, the president of Al-Quds University, the Arab University in Jerusalem, and a longtime proponent of a negotiated peace agreement. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Sari Nusebe. He's the president of Al-Quds University in East Jerusalem. He's a longtime advocate of trying to negotiate a two-state peace plan in the Middle East. Now, as the president of Al-Quds University in East Jerusalem, you've created several partnerships between Palestinian and Israeli professors. What's happening with that? And is it becoming more difficult for you to have partnerships like that?
Yes, it's more difficult. I mean, I'll give you an example. Not at the level of professors, but in this case, we've had a request from some visiting delegation of French students and professors, French Jews, a request to meet with, to come and visit our campus and meet with Palestinian students. Now, in the past 2 or 3 years, in fact, this particular group of students have been visiting our campus. And my students have been receiving them. They've had discussions. They didn't necessarily agree, you know, the one side with the other and everything, but at least there was a kind of, there was the welcoming attitude on the part of the students on my campus for those visits. Now, this time around, this year, the group once again asked to visit, and I asked the students, you know, the student union, would you like to once again receive this group of Jewish students? And the students, you know, very politely told me, no, sir, the atmosphere in the campus is not very, you know, welcoming at the moment. We think it's better if we postpone this visit. So this is a reflection, I think, of the changed attitudes. I mean, the people that I was talking to on the Palestinian side, the students themselves as individuals, were people who in the past have received such students, but today they feel a little bit threatened, perhaps a little bit more timid about doing this, a little bit.
Do they feel threatened and timid, or angry? Which is it?
No. In this case, I think probably timid, worried that their constituency, and the student body would react against them.
Oh, I see.
And so, you know, they're a bit worried about this. And so they said to me, look, we don't think this is the opportune time. We should perhaps postpone it. And I think this just reflects, perhaps, general attitude or mood. At the level of professors and operations at that level, you know, we still continue to have cooperation. You know, if you're a professor at my university doing research, say, with an Israeli colleague in physics or chemistry or what have you, you'll still be doing it. So, you know, we still have cooperative projects going on at that level.
I want to ask you your opinion of the Bush administration plan to change the Middle East and make it more democratic by invading Iraq. The idea was you invade Iraq, overthrow Saddam Hussein, create democracy in Iraq. Democracy spreads across the Middle East, making a peace plan between Israel and the Palestinians more likely. Looking at that plan and looking at where you think we are now, what's your assessment of the Bush administration approach?
Well, I said earlier that I wasn't a great believer in the use of violence as a means to achieving ends, however good those ends seem to be. Somehow or another, it seems that it always self-destructs. It sort of it doesn't seem to help. And I would have much rather violence was not used in Iraq. And, you know, if I were suggesting or making or giving advice at the time, I would have suggested, in fact, focusing on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict
first,
rather than Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I would have suggested that all effort be placed into trying to make the peace plan here work, because I believe that once you are able to tip the balance here in this conflict, once you turn things around, I think it is then that you can have the domino effect that the Bush administration was hoping it would happen, would take place after Iraq. I think democracy can grow out of peace. I don't think democracy can come through war.
Do you think that you're going to actually see a peace plan that works in your lifetime?
Well, to tell you the truth, you know, I have never been so pessimistic as I am today about a plan that will work in the foreseeable future. But look, having said this, I want to say, nonetheless, everything is possible. If I'm losing faith, it's losing faith in those that have the power to make things happen, not in the fact that things can be made to happen. I think things can be made to happen. I think the United States can, in fact, lead the international community to create a miracle here. I think that's possible, and I think the people, Israelis and Palestinians, will welcome it. But I'm not sure, given how I've seen politicians and leaders behaving, to what extent politicians and leaders we have in the States or elsewhere actually up to the challenge of creating miracles here.
Sari Nusebe, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Sari Nusebe is the president of Al-Quds University, the Arab University in Jerusalem. Earlier, we heard from Yossi Beilon, a member of the Israeli Knesset. They're both advocates of a negotiated two-state peace agreement.